This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
And my name is Natasha Mitchell from ABC Radio National's Life Matters program. And tonight is about dementia and optimism. I want to acknowledge that we gather on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation, and we thank their elders, and we thank all elders. And we also congratulate Christine Bryden for even getting close to finally being able to claim the name of elder and seize it with both hands. She's now a grandmother, I think, of four grandchildren, yep. And she never anticipated that she would ever get to meet those little people. So congratulations.
That's right.
In Christine's new book, Before I Forget, she writes, if you allow this diagnosis to define you, if you believe in the long-held toxic lie about dementia, that people with dementia have nothing to contribute, nothing to add, and are on their way to becoming an empty shell, it will become your self-fulfilling prophecy. Christine was diagnosed with dementia at the tender age of 46, in 1995. Just imagine receiving that diagnosis. Perhaps you have, perhaps one of your family members have. She was in the thick of a high-flying career as a science advisor for the then Prime Minister. She was the single mother of three daughters. One daughter was in primary school, one was in high school, one was just starting university. She'd also finally managed to extricate herself from a very violent, angry long-term relationship with her children's father. So there was a lot going on. It was a time that would have marked the beginning of the rest of her life. But what happened was that she received a diagnosis of dementia instead. 20 years on, she's become really part of the first generation of people living with dementia who want to challenge and shift our understanding of what it means to live and thrive and survive for as long as you can with a diagnosis of dementia. And that's a fundamental paradigm shift in our understanding of this diagnosis, as difficult and as individual as a diagnosis of dementia is. Christine was the first person with dementia to join the board of the Alzheimer's Disease International Organisation. How's that for a major step forward when you actually have people with a lived experience representing the discussion about this disease? She's the author of Who Will I Be When I Die, of Dancing with Dementia, and now Before I Forget. Christine joins us tonight with her husband, Paul Bryden, who had a long career in international relations in foreign affairs and in various diplomatic and public service roles, retired, fell in love with Christine after her diagnosis of dementia, and they have forged this incredible partnership of advocacy, explaining what it means to live with dementia, but also to be, well, there's carer, there's care partner, there's lover, and now they're using the word enabler instead. So let's give them a warm welcome. And we will involve you in the conversation too, and we are recording tonight, and there will be a book signing at the end. Dementia and optimism is the theme for tonight's event, and we just don't think of those two words. It's normally dementia and death sentence. That's the natural coupling in people's consciousness, isn't it?
Definitely. And that's what it was for me too at the beginning. You know, you'll have, 5 years till you become demented and then another 3 in care till you die. So I wasn't optimistic for a year or so. And then I thought, I got angry actually because of the media coverage of dementia was always so negative. So, there was coverage, I think that was right, of Ronald Reagan and who's Alzheimer or something. I think it was just so negative. And I wrote to the newspaper. That was the beginning of my march, long march to being positive, I suppose. And then they interviewed me, and then there was a full-page article, then there was TV, and then I wrote a book. And but, you know, even then, that was back in 1996, 6, 7, in the year 2000, Alzheimer's Disease International, in its annual report, talked about people with dementia being mindless, empty shells.
So they were the movement itself was using the language.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And when I phoned up our local Alzheimer's Australia for help back in whenever it was, they said, "Oh, who are you looking after?" I said, "Well, it's me." They said, "Oh, no, we don't have any support for you." And, you know, you might laugh, but back then we lacked insight. We were mindless, empty shells. So obviously there was no support for us, because if we could speak, if we had insight, then we couldn't possibly have dementia. It was a peculiar way of thinking. So I did get angry. I did get mystified. I thought, that's not right. That's ridiculous. And so there's all these people hiding away somewhere with a diagnosis of dementia, thinking they're mindless, empty shells, and then acting as if they are because everybody tells them they are. So, yeah, I then started lobbying and speaking out in public, and people were then telling me that I wasn't a credible representative because I could speak. So you're obviously not someone with dementia.
Because what was their perception of what you should be?
The usual, you know, when we talk, when we see the media usually have something about Alzheimer's or dementia, there are usually shots of people from the back in wheelchairs in a nursing home, and that is the picture, and it still is. It's what I call, it's the stereotype. It's the stereotype that drives the toxic lie of dementia, that we are lacking in insight. We're all mindless, empty shells. So it means, the corollary of that means, that you go into the doctor to get the diagnosis and you walk out a mindless, empty shell. That doesn't seem right to me. I mean, I drove to the doctor. It doesn't seem right that I walk out, pay the bill, and now I'm a mindless, empty shell. That's just ridiculous. But back then, it wasn't.
But, and 20 years on from your diagnosis, you do confuse people. And you do address this in the memoir, because so many people's experience of a loved one having dementia or their own experience of dementia can be a much more rapid decline than yours. And the medical profession, in reconfirming your diagnosis a number of times, would describe you as an outlier.
Yeah, definitely. An enigma or a puzzle or, you know, remarkable or whatever, because the brain disappears, you know, it's a disease that attacks the brain, you know, 100-odd diseases that attack the brain in different ways. And I've known a lot of dear friends over the years die quite quickly with dementia of various sorts. So yes, it wasn't certain at the beginning. So I just kept on going every year, and they kept on tracking me and saying, well, you know, your functioning seems to be glacially slow, the decline. So it is a puzzle. And I'm not saying that everybody should be like me still here after 20 years at all. I'm just saying take every day as a positive day.
What was going on in your life when you got the diagnosis? What wasn't going on in your life when you got the diagnosis,
well,
maybe?
Well, you know, a frenetic week at work, chairing meetings and rushing from, you know, the Prime Minister's office and the Minister's office and writing briefings and managing a big program of research centres. Then we managed, the divorce settlement had come through, so I managed to find a little townhouse, so couldn't take any time off work. So we moved on the Saturday into the townhouse.
You and your three daughters?
Me and my three daughters, yep, because my, you know, we'd escaped from first husband, not this dear fellow here, the previous year, I think, yes.
And it was an escape. It was a very violent relationship.
It was horrible.
And you had had your whole sense of selfhood shattered by that experience.
Yeah, I just kept on putting on a happy face, though, at work. And I still put on a happy non-dementia face, but, you know, there's stuff going on behind my happy non-dementia face. But, yeah. So we moved house that weekend, and then I had the appointment with the neurologist on the Monday morning. So I thought, well, I'll rush off from work quickly to the neurologist, get that appointment over and done with, and then rush off back to work. And that's when he diagnosed me. And, you know, just looking at my brain scans with his back towards me, saying, oh, you've got Alzheimer's disease. You've got to leave work straight away. You shouldn't be in any responsible position.
Wasn't the most compassionate neurologist in that first encounter.
No.
He was pretty blunt, wasn't he? You were kind of left to deal with the diagnosis on your own.
Yes, he just said, oh, just see my receptionist and pay on the way out. And that was it.
Is that an exaggeration?
No, that's what he said.
It just blows my mind.
I just can't say who he is. No. Still,
but what had been going on cognitively for you that led you to that appointment?
Well, you see, I didn't think there was anything really wrong, just headaches. Mm. So I had the brain scan, and obviously a lot of brain was missing, and I thought, well, maybe it's always been missing and I've just managed, you know. Obviously a lot of silly thinking was going on. But then looking back, once I got the diagnosis, I realised there were things I'd muddled up, names at work, and I'd never done anything like this. And I'd lost the thread of conversation, and I'd never done, you know, things that I'd never, ever done before.
In the middle of job interviews, losing the thread of what you were trying to say.
Because I always had got jobs that had never...
Well,
I'd
they
never.
Poached you. You were headhunted. You were
So
you
then
were
when
very
I
desirable.
Went for a couple of jobs and didn't get them, I thought, perhaps I won't. And then I was headhunted for another one, and I thought, no, I won't go for that. I don't think I'm good enough anymore.
You'd lost your confidence. What impact did that diagnosis have on you in the years after, the months and years after?
Dreadful.
Your new and your daughters.
Dreadful for all of us. And for us, for my daughters in particular, I think it took them at least 10 years to get over it. Mm. I mean, we look back now and we're okay. But they're still, they'd only just come out of that terrible, dysfunctional family environment, and then living alone and then so dependent on me as their mum and provider. I'd always been the provider, but so dependent on me as their,
their
emotional
everything.
Support.
Their well, they everything. Were little.
Yes, they called me the cog in the wheel. Is that the cog or the hub? Whatever it is.
I mean, Ianthe was only 18 or so.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And your littlest was only nine. Tiny little one.
Eight or nine, and something like that.
So tiny.
Yes, and then I broke the news to them not well. And there was no help to know how to do that. And I didn't know how much time, because the more sympathetic doctor had said to me, if you want to do anything, do it quickly. Mm. If you need, get your affairs in order. And I said, well, how long will I be able to sign and do things? He said, I don't know. 6 months? Don't know. Just do things quickly, get round to things. So I thought, well, I have to tell my daughters, get my eldest daughter the power of attorney. So yes, it was a nightmare. And then I was on the very first anti-dementia medication. And let me say, there are some wonderful anti-dementia medications out there now. Mm. They are well worth people trying to persevere with for a few months at least, if they can. But the first one, it was a tussle between your tummy and your brain, because both... You either got a really relatively okay brain and an absolutely appalling tummy with nausea and diarrhea and liver damage, or you couldn't think straight. So, yeah, and you had to take it every 4 hours? 2 hours before? I don't know. It was very complicated.
It was pretty rough. What were you feeling on the inside? What was the interior experience? I mean, you... Work was a big part of who you were, your intellectual life. You were an over-functioner. You were tough on the people around you at work. You were such an over-functioner.
Sorry, everybody. If there's anybody who ever worked for me, I'm very sorry.
Your daughter said, Mum, you getting dementia is like a concert pianist having their hands chopped off.
It was. And that's what shook me to the core, because that's who I was. I knew a lot of things and I could cross-correlate a lot of things, and it was just who I was. I wasn't a people person. I didn't have feelings, apart from for my daughters, obviously. I just was very driven, task-oriented, and facts and figures and all of that being taken away, and all of a sudden I'm at home. I tried to look positively even then, thinking, oh, it's light. I'm at least at home, not in the dark.
Forced retirement at home.
Yes. And I tried planting flowers and baking cakes. That was not really very successful, none of which I'm very good at. And I collected the girls from school, and that was very special. Rather than them going to after school care and things, I tried to look on the positive side, but I was very, very down.
And frightened.
And frightened. Horrible fear of dying in a state of unknowing and not knowing my daughters. That was the thing, even now, still rocks me, because it's inevitable. However long I try, well, yes, I could get killed in a car crash. That would be a blessing in some ways, because if I last long enough, that's, you know, I'll die that way. And that must be so lonely. So that's what really was my fear. Mm. You know, who will I be when I die, if I die with dementia?
And at that time you get a growth on your leg. It's okay, it's not, I think it was non-cancerous.
It was benign, yeah.
Benign. But you were disappointed.
I was.
Because that would have been a solution.
Yes, because I would still be relatively there, dying.
You know? Say you weren't a feelings person, but something took you to a dating website, an introductions agency, a couple of years later, because you were lonely.
I was lonely. When I told my eldest daughter that's what I was going to do, she really probably thought the dementia had got to me. But, but you know, I went, nicely dressed, thought, you know, I'd try and dress up. And, you know, said that I wasn't working. I tried desperately to think of how to avoid the topic as to what was wrong with me. And I didn't mention it. Yeah.
So, Paul Bryden.
So he was the second bloke.
Right. Mm. I thought he was the first.
Oh, no. The first ran a cemetery and told me about the way to...
Oh, black humour.
Yeah, and we had a coffee, and then I rattled my keys and said, oh, I've got to go and collect the girls, because he told me how much weight of bones were left over. I thought, whoa.
No, that's not what you needed in your life. So, Paul, the first date. The first date.
Well, the first phone call, you were nervous.
Yes, it was my first date. I'd been to the same agency. And I was very nervous. I rang up. She sounded nervous, and we met on the steps of the National Library in Canberra, and we went for a bit of a walk, and 6.5 hours later we were still walking. She could walk, I can tell you that. It's funny, I just didn't know what to do. And then Christine said, oh, would you like to go to a movie tomorrow? And I said, yeah.
So, that's a successful date, 6 hours in.
We found a lot to talk about. It was quite interesting.
Including my diagnosis.
Including the diagnosis. Yes. After 1.5 hours, when we were having lunch, she told me she had a diagnosis of dementia, and my father had died with Alzheimer's several years earlier. So something just said in my head, I can handle that. I can still remember it very clearly. And here we are.
It's a clangor in the first hour and a half of the first date, though, isn't it? And by the way, I've got dementia. Yeah, your father had died of Alzheimer's disease not long before.
That's right.
What had been your experience of that?
Well, he was in Sydney, so my older and younger brothers and their families tended to look after him. I visited a few times, not very pleasant. There was just no treatment in those days. It was locks, bolts and bars. Couldn't get out of his room, always wanted to go home. It was not good. And I suppose, just thinking about it, when I did meet Christine, maybe that encouraged me to get involved in advocacy as well.
Yeah.
Because I could see that there was a real need, that all the focus had been on the family rather than the person with dementia. I mean, they had physical restraints and pharmaceutical restraints and things, and no understanding. This is back 25 years.
Well, the use of antipsychotics in nursing care has increased, and it's clearly understood that there's an overuse in order to manage challenging behaviours, as they get described.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's not call them that.
Well, let's come back to that, because you talk about the dementia prison, and this is a very vital conversation to have. But 6 months later, is it true? You're married?
Well, it was a year later.
A year later.
By the time I'd met his lovely children too.
It was, that was a pretty passionate connection.
And we both helped set up Alzheimer's Australia ACT, and I became president of it. And Christine was the first person with dementia to be on an Alzheimer's committee, and that was the ACT.
Yeah, in Australia.
Right. In Australia.
And internationally.
And, you know, that election to the international board was only 3 years after they were calling us mindless empty shells. So they listened. Perhaps I made them listen, but, you know.
How significant was that, you representing the lived experience?
Very much so. And apparently I got the most votes that any elected representative had ever had, because I'd given a few passionate speeches to their conferences, and it made them think, who were they there for? Why were they there? Yes, to support families, very, very important, because, you know, I'll be more and more reliant on Paul, and he'll need a lot of support. But it's, you get the diagnosis and you do need support.
But the relationship hasn't, even in those early, I mean, you jumped straight to, and then I became the president of the local branch of Alzheimer's Australia.
Yeah.
But in fact, what you did together was have, and continue to have, a lot of wonderful adventures together.
Oh,
dementia
yeah,
isn't necessarily the sole substrate of the relationship.
Oh. No. I think
adventure with dementia.
Adventure with dementia, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Not that thing they say, adventure,
adventure before
together.
Dementia. It seemed to be a pretty good fit. Christine really got focused on the science of things. And I was able to write submissions and reports and things. I was able to make arrangements, travel arrangements or whatever. It seemed to be a pretty good fit, actually.
So you love each other too.
Yeah, you've just jumped to the the advocacy stuff again. I mean, has this disease come to define your relationship?
No. I think what defines our relationship?
Get the boxing gloves to say that.
I think we love each other, basically.
I think.
Yes. And we enjoy each other's company.
I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, we enjoy each other's company. And, for example, we've done two, in the last couple of years, we've done two quite long sea voyages, 7 weeks, 8 weeks. And you don't go on a boat that long unless you enjoy somebody's company, because you spend a lot of time together. And we just enjoy bouncing around together.
Yeah. Yep. How would you describe your role, not beyond, okay, so beyond the lover, partner, husband, how do you describe your role?
Well, initially it was carer. That's a very important word. Then I started to think about it, and we came up with a slightly changed perspective for care partner, because Christine cares for me as well. You know, it's kind of a we were trying to get in the idea of a mutual relationship, not just a one way. And now I describe myself as an enabler, that what I'm doing in our life together enables Christine to do the best she can. So I might do a lot of things, very practical things. For example, if it wasn't for me, she wouldn't be here. Just very practical things.
As
like
in here, right now, in this building called the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne.
Because I wouldn't know how to get here, or when to get here, or what day it is. So that, that's all of that.
All of that sort of thing. So arrangements, practical things. I do the ironing, cooking, and whatever.
Oh, you're lucky.
But
you've lucked out.
But aren't I lucky to have this wonderful wife who's really making a difference?
We need to acknowledge that with a clap. Thank you, folks. You talk about all sorts of tricks that you've developed to function in the world.
To fake normality,
To be here having this conversation.
Yeah.
What are some of those tricks and what are they masking?
Well, they're masking very high levels of anxiety, constant. Trying to learn to not worry. The fact that I don't know what day it is, what's tomorrow or what happened yesterday. And then speaking a lot more slowly. I used to speak very, very fast and my mouth couldn't keep up with the brain. Now the mouth is waiting for the words and then they often are not the right ones and I think, oh, that's not the right word. But I think, well, I better get on with it because otherwise I lose the thread.
Mm.
And then not worry about the fact that vocabulary is going. So I simplify my talks over the years, take out big words, not only because of the vocabulary, I can't pronounce them anymore, so I have to avoid big words.
And you talk about a sort of stickiness, a feeling of sticky brain.
Yeah, it's sluggish in there. It feels like walking in treacle. My thoughts are a bit clunky. And then also thoughts, they just like puffs of fairy dust. They're there. I turn around to say something. I gape like a fish and the thought's gone. Or I try and write it down or stick it in the phone and it's gone. It's very frustrating. Paul's role is to calm me down most of the time because I spend a lot of the time getting very annoyed.
Yeah, do you get angry?
Oh, yes, I do.
Oh, yes, she gets angry.
Yeah.
Not at me so much, but with herself, I think.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, just yesterday, for example, she was getting very stressed out about actually coming here. And I said, why don't you take the dog for a walk? And she said, oh, what a good idea, thanks. And took the dog for a walk, a 40-minute walk. And came back and you were fine.
Yeah.
But Christine hadn't thought that, oh, maybe if I take the dog for a walk, I'll feel better, you know. Mm. So, yes, gets very anxious.
Yep. And then the other day, because I've been using the iPhone as my eye brain, because it's the calendar.
I think we all use the iPhone as Android in my case.
It's great, because people ring up and say, did you have a good day yesterday? Hold on. Ah, yes, it was great going to whatever it was I did, like here. Or they say, are you looking forward to tomorrow? I think, just hold on. Yeah, that'd be good, whatever I'm doing tomorrow, don't know. Because I woke up earlier this week, tapped on the calendar like I normally do, first thing in the morning, cup of tea, blank. Mm. The whole of the calendar had disappeared. And it's amazing because for me, it was like my whole life, my whole thought process, all my future ideas, plans, my week, Monday, Tuesday, all those had gone. I was just blank. It was
horrific. The ultimate living in the moment experience, isn't it? And you talk about that kind of you suddenly come to sort of occupy the pinhead of time.
Absolutely. Mm. You're just in the present moment. And it was exceedingly unsettling at the moment because I'm not on a cruise ship doing nothing. I'm busy doing stuff. And the fact that all that stuff had disappeared into the ether was really alarming. But so Paul had to calm me down. He's still trying to resurrect and reconstruct the calendar. So
Yes, it's dangerous placing your life in the hands of the digital masters.
Yes.
One day it might all just collapse in one big virus and then what will we do? What about your daughters? Because they've been living with this diagnosis for 20 years and they were very traumatised for a long time. And they were young, so and Mum was going to die very soon.
And they were already traumatised by the family life beforehand. Well, my eldest daughter became the carer role, the strong one. And she took a year off university. She was going to look after her, well, she did. She took, moved nearby, was able to look after. I think one of the girls went to live with her because I couldn't cope with two at once because siblings always argue. And by the time they'd finish arguing, I couldn't remember who'd said what to whom and whose fault it really was. So, you know, I was useless. And, you know, trying to cope, it was very difficult. So the
And they were scared?
They were. And my middle daughter, she was 13, 14, she just withdrew, very quiet. Withdrew, just went very, very quiet.
Found horses.
Found horses, just quiet with horses. And the youngest girl was just started playing up at school, got into trouble, always having to stand in the corner, was called a liar, that's right. When she actually wrote in her journal, what's it called, the show and tell or something when you go in the Monday?
Yeah.
What her mum had told her at the weekend. She was called up in front of the principal's office and told a liar because the journal is for telling the truth, not making up stories. So she got no support.
Yeah, no understanding.
And so really from then on her life and my middle daughter's lives became very, very troubled. And it became very difficult for Paul and I to deal with because I was trying to deal with my own issues. As well as my daughters clearly both feeling very, very troubled. I didn't feel I had the capacity to be who I needed to be. And Paul's role as a stepdad is difficult. He's not their dad. He got told that a few times. But
you took the caring burden, the enabling burden, but then it was very much a caring burden, carer burden off the daughters in a sense, didn't you?
Yes. Indeed, indeed.
Yeah, particularly but from Yanthi, she could go back to university.
That's right. It made a big difference to Yanthi. I think they now accept me.
Definitely.
Definitely. Yep. I think they regard me
but
as
But even that
as
hesitation.
Yeah.
Gee.
Well, I know for a fact that they've always told me that the only dad they've got is Paul. But, you know, writing the book, I needed their memories to try and work back into my first marriage. And it was very traumatic for us all. So a lot of tears were shed in just getting some of that stuff together. And some of it didn't go in the book because it was just too horrible.
But the dedication at the front of the book, and I'll just read that, is... for my husband, Paul, who enables me to struggle to survive. For my daughters, Ianthi, Rhiannon and Micheline, who have come through the trauma to a place of peace.
Yeah.
And so they are at peace now.
Yes. But it was another healing process we needed to go through because Paul had helped us come through the sort of diagnosis impact, but we hadn't revisited the trauma of the first marriage, and this book we revisited it in getting the book together, but quite a lot of stuff didn't go in there because it
was too tough.
Too tough.
Before we come to you for comments and questions, I do want to ask about this description you use in presentations, the dementia prison.
Yes.
And this is your description of the existing culture of dementia care in mainstream nursing homes, dementia units. Describe what you're observing.
Well, I was asked to give a talk to nursing home care managers, and I thought once I sent them the talk, they wouldn't want me to give it to them because I said it was called Dreading Going into Dementia Prison.
Mm.
But in the end, I was asked to give it over and over and over again, same talk. Basically, you go into a nursing home and it's lovely, chintzy type staff and, you know, lovely friendly staff, lovely vases of flowers. And then they show you into the dementia care ward, punch in a code, you go behind some locked doors, it smells different, it is different. The people are all sitting there parked around tables, usually about four to a table, and they're just parked. They've been parked there since their shower in the morning and they're just left there. And the staff are chattering away around them as if they're not there. They're mindless empty shells.
And in fact, that sort of context and environment and inactivity can accelerate your cognitive decline.
Absolutely. If I'm there for a while, I get very brainless, really. Paul takes me away after about an hour because there's also competing noises. There's the staff chattering. They have TV on and radio and just clattering and banging of dishes coming in and out. And I just get... It's too much for me, so I need to rest.
So we've got it wrong, is what you're arguing, isn't it?
Yep.
We've got it wrong. How could we get it right?
Well,
how could we recognise the humanity of ourselves when we have those needs?
Yes, people with disability have the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights for People with Disability, yet people with dementia are not regarded as under that category for some reason. I regard my dementia as a disability, and yet I'm not. And one of the rights of a person with disability is to live in the community. But people with dementia get locked away. There is a small movement of small group homes, like the ones we have for people with disabilities who live in small homes together with carers. But no, people with dementia are locked away in large institutions. They're institutionalised. And I ponder why that is. I suppose that's my next...
And your agency is stripped away from you. And
absolutely,
you are always an agent for as long as you're alive and your heart is beating and your brain is alive.
But not in the dementia prison. Somebody comes and tells you when to shower. They come and attack you, if you like. They come and drag you out of your bed, put you in the shower. They often don't talk to you while they do that. They talk to each other. And you're showered, dressed, and, you know. Obviously, it's not like that in every...
No, and there are a lot of very, caring people who work in the industry.
A lot of caring people, and let me just say, the people who work with people with dementia are wonderful.
Mm.
It must be soul-destroying to try and work within time limits and cost constraints and all of that, when what you want to do is to show humanity and connect person to person. But there's got to be a better way.
Paul, you as an enabler have had to think quite strategically about what you do and don't do for Christine, and you together present to other groups of carers all around the world about that dynamic, because you need to hand over responsibility to Christine for parts of her life keep challenging her brain.
Yep. No, that's exactly right. There are some things which it's just better if I do it. Simple as that. Driving, for example. Christine can drive, but I know it's tiring for her, and it can become quite exhausted. So, I just do the driving.
Most of the time. I mean, when we're together, I do drive by myself to book club. Yeah.
Christine finds the vacuum cleaner impossible to put together. All those tubes and bits of wire and stuff. So it's natural that I do that. But she's very good at concentrating and focusing on reading and writing, writing talks, for example, preparing for events, writing a book or whatever. She can really do that. So whatever I can do to relieve her of things that are frustrating or whatever, I'm very conscious of not infantilizing or teaching what directing helplessness and saying, oh no, you can't do that. I would never want to do that.
I think an important part of your role as an enabler or carer or whatever, care partner, whatever it is knowing when I'm losing the plot.
Yeah.
Because I don't know I'm losing the plot.
How do you lose the plot?
It's a bit like a two-year-old losing the plot. I lose the plot like a two-year-old, don't I?
Well, that's right.
Yeah, I have a meltdown.
You have a vocabulary which is richer than a two-year-old's. More like a sailor's. So I know something's going wrong in the stuff. When I hear some blasphemous remarks going on, and it might be just the paper jammed in the printer, so just go and fix it up.
It's just life is too much and trying to get through everything and coping with whatever's just gone wrong. It's like being very fragile. It's like just being on very thin surface and it cracks and I fall through.
I feel we'd be remiss in not talking about this very briefly before I open for audience questions. But your faith, Christianity, has been a massive part of what's kept you going.
Absolutely.
And feeling strong and at peace. And you came to religion quite late in your life, late in your 40s, really, as a scientist who wouldn't have necessarily been inclined to maintain a faith. But it has been a big support for you and a community of support, hasn't it?
Yep, both of those. And yes, it happened to me. I didn't find it really. Faith, belief happened to me, which was such a blessing because it meant that I had a community around me in order to leave my first husband. I know it sounds awful, but it was that Christian community that gave me the confidence, but also could see what was happening. It was also my faith that got me through the dark times at the beginning of this journey before I met Paul. And in fact, probably got me, it did definitely, because I remember thinking clearly, I'm going to pick up my mat and walk. You know, I'm going to get over this. I'm going to not pretend this isn't happening, but I'm going to get out there and do things, meet people, and put dementia more in a box.
And did it help you grapple with the existential aspects of...
Definitely.
The disease?
Definitely. Because I know in my heart, in my faith, that this is not all there is. So therefore, my decline and death in a state of unknowing is a temporal thing. Mm. It doesn't mean that it's my spirit that's changing. It's my cognition and my emotions, but not my inner spirit. So that, to me, is a great source of strength.
And comfort.
Mm.
Mm. Let's open up the conversation to you. We have two mics roving around. Wait for the mic to get to you if you can. And keep your comment or your question fairly brief so we can get around the room. Thank you.
Yeah, hi, Kristen. I hope it's not a difficult question, but do you have any thoughts on voluntary euthanasia and perhaps what does Alzheimer's International, what is the view on voluntary euthanasia?
Thank you. So the question is about voluntary euthanasia.
It's certainly a very difficult issue, and there is no position, as far as I'm aware, taken by Alzheimer's Australia, nor by Alzheimer's Disease International. I think Terry Pratchett was very much promoting...
The late, great Terry Pratchett?
Yep, who had dementia.
And early onset.
Yeah. Mm. So I remember coming across that whole question right at the beginning of my journey when I met on the internet an American ex-professor who has Alzheimer's, who's still out there doing things and writing, and he joined the Hemlock Society, which is promoting and talking about suicide. But he's still around. He hasn't taken his own life, and he has a long life. My own view, for what it's worth, is that if we could only show a more positive side to living well with dementia, to being well supported with dementia, to getting good palliative care, I think that this whole journey it would be very different. Our fear would be very different. I think we need to think more about, why does society fear dementia so much? Why is it the most feared disease in Australia? What is it about it? It is that death in a state of unknowing, but perhaps we can think about those years of living well.
Do you have a thought to add there, Paul?
No, it doesn't particularly appeal to me. I'm very taken with Christine's description of the outer shell, but the spirit remaining. And we've actually experienced people in the last stages of dementia, and the spirit was there. Mm. People hadn't spoken for months, just mute. And I'll give you an example of a very strange one. A Glaswegian lady speaking with an accent that I couldn't understand in Tokyo, just stroking the hand of a Japanese lady who hadn't spoken for 6 months. And after about an hour, the Japanese lady sat up and started talking and saying, oh, that's wonderful, that's wonderful. So the conference organisers dashed off and got the family so they could put their arms around mum. Now, that was spirit to spirit. It wasn't a religious thing. It wasn't like, Psalm 23 to somebody who's familiar with Psalm 23 and they suddenly start reciting it, although that happens. But I was very impressed with just that warmth and that touch, and this lady who hadn't spoken for months and months and was just lying there asleep, she could just feel, I don't know, a good spirit, love or whatever, with this Glaswegian lady who I couldn't understand. So it wasn't. Yeah.
And it's interesting, you've become a celebrity in Japan, such as the interest, because an older population there, and dementia is becoming an issue for the Japanese. Another question, thanks, or comment. Oh, I'm going to pop your hand up and I'll come to you, but I want to ask about difficult behaviours called.
Yes.
Because it's a great source of confusion and distress for nursing home staff, for family members and carers, and of great suffering.
It is. And it's called challenging behaviour. It's got called the behavioural and psychological symptoms of dementia. Now, the behaviours that are exhibited are certainly challenging to the person being mystified by what's happening around. Why is that person doing all of that? But I'd never call it a symptom of dementia. I'd call it a sign of distress. The person with dementia is trying to communicate and can't have words anymore, doesn't have words, doesn't have the ability to communicate well, and yet is very distressed by being forced into something or worried about the future. It might be something we just don't know. So it's behaviour that is mystifying. It's behaviour that should be seen as communication. It's non-verbal communication. It can be shouting, screaming, swearing.
It can be physical.
It can be physical. What I don't want us to do is to medicalise it. And by calling it a symptom of dementia, we risk medicalising it and then giving people tablets. Yes, certainly tablets might be desperately needed by some families to help, where it is becoming physical and, you know, they're in harm's way. But there is a lot of support. DBMAS, what's that called? It's the Alzheimer's Australia Dementia and Behaviour Management Advisory Service, that's right. It will help for free. It will come and provide advice, support and help to families struggling.
And there are tools and techniques and all sorts of interesting examples about organisations and institutions that are trying to respond to those more challenging situations. Yeah. Amazing nursing homes who really just have upended the whole paradigm of care.
And seen it as a way of communicating. What is this person trying to tell us? Mm. What is distressing them? What in the environment? Is it the noise? Is it the movement? Do they want to go home? Which is highly likely.
We'll come back to you. And you might be in the audience with a relative or a lived experience of dementia, and you might have been, something might be just niggling at you about what you've heard today, or a question or a comment. I'd love to hear from you. Yeah, so, we'll come to you. I'll come to you first. Yeah.
So, Christine, could you perhaps explain, if you know, why you are an outlier? I mean, what is it, have scientists probed you, and why is it that you've had this extraordinary long life after your diagnosis?
I suppose if we knew, we'd bottle it, but probably a number of things. First of all, what I was like beforehand, which was very cognitive, very high level of education and ability and verbal skills. Secondly, the pathology, the damage to my brain, is presumably going a little bit slower than expected. Thirdly, being very positive and having Paul's support and enablement. And I suppose acceptance.
And cognitive reserve, as it gets described. You think about your childhood. You think your childhood might have had quite a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
I mean, you and your mum did IQ tests for fun.
We did. We did.
And then, I mean, they are quite fun to do. I'm too scared to do them now.
I was about 7 or 8 and we were doing them for fun and competing against each other to score higher and higher on the little charts. And she was doing all sorts of games. I talk about them in the book. Just what she did with me. Mm. Now I realise, my goodness, they were building my cognitive reserve.
You were an over-functioner, which might have helped you at this stage.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Can I just add to that?
Yeah.
Back in 2000, we helped set up an internet support group called Dementia Advocacy Support Network International. Mm. And we went over to America and met some people. Now, there were 12 original members of that organisation with dementia. One died a few years ago from heart disease. The other 11 are still active in their local communities in Canada, Hawaii, England, and America and Australia.
Mm.
So Christine's not unique, an outlier, but there are, you know, we do know other people who've, done very well.
And you're the first generation of people ever history, ever, to self-advocate, to offer peer-to-peer support, to have a public voice,
and to
have talk in the media.
Anti-dementia drugs.
Yep.
And to have anti-dementia
drugs. Because I would never, ever minimise the importance. We used to call ourselves the Aricept generation because that was one of the drugs, the very first, well, the second. Now there are several more on the market, Exelon, Bivastigmine, and Aricept and Memantine, I think. Anyway, there's a number. Without my anti-dementia drug, I wouldn't be able to speak by now because you put it on in the morning, and Paul's described it like WD-40 on a misfiring car. It works.
I want some of that.
Yeah. Yeah, my daughters said, "Oh, can we have some for our exams, Mum?"
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Christine, I'm interested in the question of diagnosis. I had a friend who died at the age of 60 and wasn't, in my mind, actually diagnosed. And she actually, I don't believe she died of dementia. She died of, I believe, some form of tumour or cancer. But my experience, if I could just relate, because at first I thought she was just depressed. And there was quite a long period of denial on my part. But I'll tell you, there were two experiences which, when I suddenly realised there was an issue. And the one was, we were shopping in Gosford, and as you do, I said I'd go into the supermarket, and she went to buy a birthday card at the newsagent. And after a while, I didn't know where she was or what happened. Mm-hmm. I went into the newsagent, and there was great confusion, because she had sort of couldn't handle the transaction. Mm-hmm. And was being accused of shoplifting. Oh. And that was the beginning of the awareness in my case. Shortly afterwards, we went down to Sydney on the harbour and got on a ferry. And as you do with a friend, you sort of assume that they can get on the ferry, and she just about stepped into the harbour. She could not find the little gangplank. Mm. And those two incidences were the diagnosis, if you like, from my part.
Mm.
And so I was just wondering on this question of diagnosis. Now, it sounded as if you had a neurosurgeon, you had some sort of scan.
Neurologist.
And so I'd like to know, is this an ongoing process? Do you get scanned regularly?
Yeah.
And this question about the motor ability, because I have a feeling that she had a great difficulty, as I said, that case where she nearly stepped into the harbour, because also when we'd go to restaurants, she could not sit down, could not find the seat, was totally disorientated. We go to the cinema, she could, and it was quite a physical effect that it had. I don't know if you could make comments on that.
Thank you for sharing that story about your friend. And, yeah, it's confusing, isn't it? And so the diagnosis, is it an ongoing process for you?
There's several points here, really, isn't it? The diagnosis thing and also the perception stuff, which maybe you'll talk about, the perception stuff. With the diagnosis, so often diagnosis is not timely. So often doctors say, oh, you've got depression or menopause or whatever, anything. They just don't look for dementia.
Menopause is the diagnostic category for everything, it seems.
Yeah, it does, really.
Sometimes.
But, you know, doctors, GPs, don't often see cases of dementia in the early stages. They might see one or two people a year. So they're not really clued in as to what to do or what to say. And it's a tragedy because the sooner someone can be on the medication now, the better they're going to keep functioning and the more likely they can get their affairs in order. It certainly sounds as if your friend had signs of dementia. I find difficulty in shops with money. You know, I just give a note across and hope for the best, or that tapping card thing, that's good now. And the perception,
dementia is not only loss of memory, it's loss of or diminished peripheral vision, for example. So you don't know where your feet are, and you kind of trip over, or you don't know. I mean, I can put my hands out 180 degrees and actually sense both hands, but some people, Christine, it's 45 degrees. It's 90 degrees. So you've got perception problems. I think processing floors, for example, where there are different coloured carpets and tiles, they, you know, to people, they look like steps or drops and whatever. There's a lot of things besides simply memory loss.
And I've been recommending people wear colourful shoes. I haven't actually got them on today, but I wear bright red shoes.
So they stand out.
If I'm on my own, because I can see them, so I don't fall over stairs. I can fall up and down stairs, you know.
Just to wrap, because we've run out of time, 10 years ago I interviewed you and together. Yes. You were in the Brisbane studios and I think I might have been in the Sydney studios of the ABC. And then the way you described it was that you were a 115-year-old brain in a 56-year-old body. Here you are 10 years later, 20 years after your diagnosis. And what do you see in the future that gives you peace?
Why am I optimistic?
And joyful.
Yes.
With this diagnosis. It's.
I suppose I'm old enough to have it now. I know that sounds sort of silly, but, you know, I finally got there. Finally I'm sort of, you know, aged officially, 66. I'm sort of used to it. I know it sounds silly, but I'm used to it now. And it's part of who I am. I've been walking this journey for a long time and analysing and reflecting on it and seeing so much meaning in life that doesn't rely on cognition. And I think we could all learn a great deal from people with dementia. Because in some ways, cognition masks a lot. It masks who we really are. We talk about what we do or whatever. We don't talk about who we are as a person. And I also find that lack of memory in the short term helps me find long term, so I can find more in the past because it's not blurred by all the recent stuff. So there's an awful lot of positives to be found, and I have got used to it.
Paul?
Yeah, I don't know about
it. You haven't got used to it, maybe.
It's interesting, the comment you just made about you can go back into the past a lot better than the future. I know you've got a beautiful image that you've written, that life's like being on a carpet that's unrolling in the future but rolling up behind you, you know, so you're in the present moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important for all of us, to be able to just enjoy, have a moment of well-being in the present moment. Whatever you're doing, try to make it the best moment you can. This could be the last day I've got. I'll try and make it my best day.
Mm.
So kind of living in the moment, but of course keeping an eye on the future, but not getting too worried about it.
But I can't keep an eye on the future.
That's Christine and Paul Bryan.
Can I ask a question? Is there anybody in the audience who has a diagnosis of dementia? Great. Could we say hello to you? Hello.
Hello.
Good on you.
Hello.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Come on, give him a round.
We'll just grab a mic. Can we pull a mic? Can I pull a mic to you if that's okay? Sorry. Thank you.
I just wanted to congratulate both of you on your courage and your optimism. My diagnosis was 2 years ago, and Christine, you and I are the same age. I just think that's fabulous. From the day I was diagnosed, I thought consistently about the prospect of being institutionalised, and I practically had the bag packed. From what you've told me, I'm going to unpack the bag and just get on with life.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Christine, so much for sharing your story so generously. I really appreciate it. And thank you very much for coming. I hope you got a lot out of the event and Christine and Paul's story. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.